Welcome to 3GT, a podcast where a pastor, parishioner, and professor have lively conversations on practical Christian living from a Reformed perspective. For more information, visit our website at 3GT.fm.
Welcome to another episode of 3GT. I'm Kyle Borg, and I'm joined today with my friends Aaron Sams and Barry York. And our topic for discussion today is going to be on what we might call Reformed Popery. Not Popery, what you put in your house to make it smell good.
Oh.
Although there's a brand. Somebody could market that.
Hey, there you go. Maybe we could get them to sponsor our show.
And get them to sponsor our show. There we go. I like that. Barry, why don't you work on that one?
I'm trying to think what it would smell like.
Tulips, obviously. Tulips.
Oh, well, there you go.
I don't know. Depending on the region and congregation, it might be like craft beer and pipe tobacco.
Right. That's true. Or for the truly reformed, forget the 5 points of tulip. We got to come up with chrysanthemum or something. So. Well, but not potpourri like the old lady air freshener, no offense to any potpourri users out there, but potpourri with relation to the Pope and whether Reformed churches might churches that might identify more with Reformed theology, do they struggle with their own ideas of little popes? And to get us started, you know, one of the standing principles of the Roman Catholic Church is that the Pope, who is the Bishop of Rome, is, according to their catechism, the full, supreme, and universal head over the whole church. And they believe that that is a power which he can always exercise unhindered. And lately, unfortunately, tragically, the Christian world has seen, even in some Reformed-ish Protestant churches, some men who seem to have surrounded themselves with a lot of yes men and in their own way become popes of their own dominions. And what do you guys think what fuels that? What do you think brings that about in some places?
Well, I think part of it has to do with, largely an American pushback towards authority. And so sometimes when new churches are started, if they're not part of a particular denomination, the tendency I've seen often is to be pretty lax on church government and pretty lax on governing documents so that, we're just going to play free and loose. We're going to let the Spirit lead. And but then what often happens then is they find a strong leader, a very charismatic leader, small c charismatic leader, that people tend to rally around, and they kind of elevate this person to a position like that. That's at least what I've noticed. Barry, any thoughts there?
Yeah, I think that really nails it a little bit. And I think it follows along with often these men rise up and they become the central part of the church, are often charismatic type leaders and get a following. And because there hasn't been, as you said, Aaron, an appropriate setting down the principles of governing over the church, that vacuums will necessarily create a power surge, and so the man begins to take more and more on himself in terms of the decision making of the church, and abuses usually quickly follow in those types of settings.
I think those are good observations, and there have been some very public downfalls of these men who have really kind of become a one-man show. And I think I'd emphasize, together with your guys' answers, that I don't think it's always intentional. I want to be very charitable. You can imagine, as you guys said, these churches are planting and they're seeking to do good and well-meaning things. And, one of the quickest ways to do that is to get, like you said, a charismatic and vibrant leader. And I think some of the churches, you hear of them and, well, he's the pastor of vision, or he's the pastor of leadership. And, it really falls on his shoulders to move the congregation forward. And I imagine that the subtle temptation in that is that counselors become more of advisors, and thanks for your advice, but I'm the one setting the vision here. And I imagine that when you pour your heart and soul into that, when you're kind of the guy that's being looked at as the single person, it can probably be hard to take no sometimes. And you know, one of the things I've noticed, and I don't think we need to mention them by name, but it's been noted by others, some of these men who have really fallen really ended up just having a bunch of yes men around them. Men that weren't willing to say, nope, that's not what we're doing, that's not the direction we're going in, but just kind of rubber stamped everything they did. And I imagine that really, that fuels an environment where I think the temptations of sinful pride and Satan can really enter in to cause these tragedies that we've seen in the news in previous years.
Right, right.
So what, clearly, there's something wrong with that. Obviously, any system of government that we might have, because we are sinful, is liable to being corrupted by sin. But biblically, do you think that the way some of this approached is wrong? And if it is wrong, what might be a more biblical way to organize the church?
Well, one of the things this draws my mind back to is our earlier episode on ordination and just how important it is for the church to realize that God does have a way of setting over the church leaders. And so we talked a lot at that point in time about how important it is for the church to recognize that God has given it leaders. And here we're particularly thinking about ministers and elders. And so they need to recognize that these men's qualifications, first of all, are very important. We see in 1 Timothy 3, Titus 1, the qualifications given for men in those positions. And I've always really tried to stress, whether it's in the classroom or in a congregation or even in presbytery exams, that first and foremost on those lists is a man's character. And so we can't get past character when we're talking about church leadership. So that'd be one place where we'd really want to start and look.
Well, Barry, I'd like to actually hear from both you and Aaron, who might come with slightly different perspectives. So, Barry, you as a pastor and as an elder in the church have been required to examine men and their biblical character. In a moment, will you walk us through some of the things that you look for, some of the questions you ask? And Aaron, from the pew side of things, you've been a member of a church where you've had to elect a pastor. What were you looking for? How would you gauge a man's character as a member of the church looking for a pastor?
Barry, you want to go first?
Sure. Well, I've actually gone through the list of qualifications and developed at times questions regarding those qualities. So, for instance, when it starts talking about an elder must be blameless, I begin to ask questions about the reputation. One of the things I was actually encouraged by in my former presbytery is that instead of only asking the man, what's your reputation? We began to do what a lot of employers will do. We actually asked for references, and we got letters of recommendation for these men from people who knew them, other pastors or employers that had had them there, and just to see what their reputation was like with respect to others. Talks about being a husband of one wife, and later on managing your household well, and being hospitable, so asking practices regarding the relationship of the man with his wife and how he guides his children. If you can't shepherd your own children and your own household well, then how, as Paul raises, can you manage the household of God? And so we just go through this list. There's questions regarding morality, questions regarding finances. There are questions about theological knowledge, and there are exams for that. But I do think we do very well as a church to pay attention to the character of a man, and particularly how he relates to others, because we're asking men to be shepherds over God's people, and it's all about how they're going to relate and love the people of God, relate to and love the people of God.
Yeah, for me, what I found to be very, very helpful is just to simply spend some time with them. So when men are out, candidating or preaching, you know, if there happens to be a get to know you event afterwards, or, you know, if there's a midweek event that they happen to show up for, or you've just hung out with them, you know, at a presbytery meeting or some other connection that you might have with them, spend time with them, spend time with their family, get to know them. Cause people are very, very different when you're just, you know, chit chatting over a bag of chips than they are, you know, from a pulpit or on a Sunday morning. And it's good to be able to kind of bounce those perspectives or personas, if you will, through the same filter to see if they line up when they've passed through the filter. And just simply spending time, and then in doing so, Barry, you can like you were mentioning, how do they manage their family? If you spend time and their mm-hmm. family's there, you can see how they relate to their kids and how they relate to their wife, and you can learn a lot that way from just simply hanging out and observing.
Mm-hmm. I really appreciate both of those. Barry, you said it, but just to echo how important character is for pastors in Reformed churches, if I can be slightly critical, and maybe we'll open the door for some more criticism, but in Reformed churches, we can often think, you know, as long as they're theologically spot on, they've got their theological T's crossed and I's dotted, that's good enough or that's sufficient. And in some sense, you know, that's easier to gauge. It's easier to quantify one's theological right. knowledge than their character. But how important character is. There are men who could dance circles around many elders probably when it comes to theological knowledge. But to have a wise, loving, gentle, Christ-like character in the eldership, to me, is worth more than somebody who could recite Louis Burkhoff's systematic theology from memory.
Hey, Barry, you mentioned when you were commenting just a minute ago about money and finances, and that's part of, you know, of running your household. Is there precedent at all? And this just came in my head, so I don't read anything into this at all, other than Aaron just had a thought run into his head. Is there any sort of precedent at all for like running a credit check on a potential pastor? I mean, if they're swimming up to the gills in debt, you know, or something like that, that's an indicator of other things. And I don't know, is that common? Do you know of that happening? Is that something you do? Is that appropriate? I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
I don't think we've ever, you know, run a legal credit check on someone. It tends to be more examining and trusting that men are telling us the truth. Although, you know, those things aren't always easy to hide either. So when you're checking references or talking to their pastor or talking to others that know them, if there are questions like that, issues like that, they tend to come out through the right questions.
Or if he rolls up in a Bentley and his kids have torn pants on and
yeah.
raises an eyebrow or something,
yeah,
you know?
That's right.
That raises an eyebrow?
Yes, Kyle, you have to sell your Bentley. Take it back to the dealer and your motorcycle.
And I've got to buy the kids shoes. That's but it's no summer.
More,
do they really
no
need
no more tattoos till you get everything else paid off?
Well, yes, one of the things, Dan, that this takes us toward is the fact that, you know, even the best of men, even men with sterling character, are still prone to temptation. It still can be a very difficult thing to manage the household of God. People come to us with all types of problems and situations that can leave us dumbfounded on how and befuddled about which way to go. And so it really points to the fact that there needs to be, you know, part of the reason that we stand against popery is we don't believe one man is sufficient in and of himself to govern over the church. We believe that Christ alone is the head of the church, and that the way that we maintain that best is by having what is practiced in Presbyterian churches, which is a group of elders overseeing the local congregation. We often call that the plurality of elders, meaning that there's more than one. And why is that such a helpful thing to have in a church, to not just have one man calling all the shots, but to have multiple men overseeing the church? And also along with that, how does that fit together with the idea of there being a pastor?
Yeah, I think for me, just the concept of checks and balances is so, so important. Knowing that if one person goes rogue, we have others who can correct that person. Or if someone is wrongly accused of something, that there is an appeals process that, that you can go through, that it's not dependent upon the whim of one individual or even a small group of individuals, that that you know you have the governance of your ruling elders in a local congregation, and you there's oversight and there's checks that go on. I had a family member of mine. They were in a church that had very loose governance structures, and did so intentionally. And they had a pastor who, as you know, we were talking earlier about, you know, yes men, he surrounded himself with people who would essentially do exactly as he told them and convinced them to give him a lifetime salary regardless of what he was actually doing. So essentially he could pastor the church or he could do anything else that he wanted to, and he would be paid indefinitely.
Wow.
And so eventually this guy went rogue where he was doing all sorts of stuff that people were starting to raise eyebrows with, had some shady like side business practices going on. But there was nothing they could do. There was no one to appeal to. And so long as his yes men were in power, if you will, and continuing to say yes, the only option for people was to leave that church and to go somewhere else, which is what my family member ended up doing. So there was no oversight. There was no appeal. There was nothing other than one guy and his decisions and the people that wanted to stay in his good graces who would continue to say yes to him. And I just see that as dangerous. I see that that is the definition of a loose cannon.
Which, Aaron, and then I'll get to Barry's question about plurality. I think that so emphasizes, I'm hopelessly Presbyterian. It's almost sad how hopelessly Presbyterian I am.
Sounds like a romantic comedy title or something. Right. Like that. Hopelessly Presbyterian.
How like that.
Starring Sandra Bullock. And
Kyle Borg. Yeah. I think that underscores the very, very pivotal place that the congregation has in Presbyterianism. Because even with a plurality of elders, you can still end up with yes men. But Presbyterianism teaches us that Christ has vested his power and authority in the whole body. Mm. And that the one way that the whole body exercises that power is in the selection of elders. I was in a church growing up where the elders were self-perpetuating. The elder board chose the elders, and that was just their cycle. And the only way you could be removed from the eldership is by a vote of the elders. And it was this very ongoing cycle where the congregation was removed from it. But Presbyterian, even though it means elder led, a foundational principle of Presbyterianism is that the people have the right to elect and select those who will govern them. And so that's where I'd say, you know, just very practically, where congregational power is so important is with the selection of elders and seeing to it that they're qualified, that they're not going to be yes men, or that they're not going to be those who come and try to run a one-man show. But Barry, back to yours, plurality, you know, scripture tells us everywhere that there's wisdom with a multiplicity of advisors, that you're foolish. It's the way of foolishness to be a one-man show and to be a lone ranger and to be set yourself up in that way. But I would add to the plurality another P word, which we often call parity, which means the equality of elders. Mm-hmm. And I think it's not only a plurality, but it is the equality. And so, Barry, you asked, you know, what relationship plurality has to the pastor. And I think this idea of equality is so important. Eastern Orthodoxy does not believe in the Roman Catholic Pope, but the Bishop of Constantinople is one among equals in one sense, but he's kind of looked at as the head honcho. But that's very removed from Presbyterianism. Mm-hmm. Presbyterianism believes in the equality of the eldership. One of the practices that I've tried to maintain as a young pastor and praying that the Lord continues in this way is when our elders sit down and we make decisions, we go around the table and every one of us shares our opinion. I don't, you know, as the moderator, I don't let any of my elders sit in silence. You've got to have an opinion on this. And what is going to be your opinion? Because we believe in the equality of elders. And that's not only true on a local session level, that has to be true on a presbytery level as well. I'm trying to think if I want to spare a comment here. I think one of the practical dangers of Presbyterianism, sometimes you're told you need to earn your stripes before you're allowed to speak at Presbytery. And I understand that to a degree. But again, it's this, even presbyteries can be run by one or two or three people who are vying for influence. But at all levels of the church, we believe in the equality of elders.
And you're really pointing to another aspect of this whole question, is that the elders aren't only just over their own congregation, but they have a responsibility to others that they're vitally connected to in a system of government. So in other words, in Presbyterian denominations, each congregation isn't autonomous just with its own elders, but it's also accountable to other churches in its region, and is connected with them doctrinally, organizationally, and in ministry activity. So, for instance, if something happens in one church and there's a need that taxes all the collected wisdom and resources of that body, they have a place where they can go to, the greater body, which we often call the presbytery, a region of churches. By way of anecdote, when I was in our ministry in a neighboring town, a pastor asked if he was in a setting where they had local elders, but they were outside any denomination. It was a non-denominational church. And he asked me if I would look at his governing documents, which were okay. But one of the things I noticed about him was that they said that in the Advent that their congregation ended up having to disband, that they would send their members to a local church that was most like them. And as I read that, I started thinking, this sounds like emergency Presbyterianism, that they're gonna ask for help when they're at the point of losing their congregation. And I was just thinking, why not have that at the very beginning for the problems that will inevitably rise? And sadly, in the case of this particular congregation, that's exactly what happened. The pastors ended up having problems, and because of that, the congregation ended up disbanding. So I'm thankful that in the Presbyterian form of government, we're there to help one another.
And to help one another, and, you know, when you think about this, my good friend Nathan Eshelman always reminds me that Presbyterianism exists because conflict exists. Mm-hmm. And if I can add to that, Presbyterianism exists because the pride of the sinful heart exists. And right. Because if all of us were not kept, as Aaron made mention earlier, with checks and balances and things like that, all of us would be vying for positions, and all of us would be vying to be a one-man show. You know, I'm certainly not above it. Barry, you're not above it. Aaron, you're not above it. Congregants, pastors, they can all be trying to run a one-man show in the church, but Presbyterianism, it really exists, and I think that's why Jesus appointed it, to deal with these things in the best possible way. And because we're sinners, it's still not going to be perfect, but it's I think, really useful.
So yes. I want to jump back a few minutes in our conversation here. Kyle, you were talking about this, you know, Presbyterianism means elder-led. And what, so, and we've been talking about the danger of having one person calling all the shots. Is there a danger of a session of elders overstepping as well? So, you know, we've talked about one individual overstepping. So I guess my question is there a distinction to be made between a congregation that's elder led and a congregation that's elder controlled? Is that a danger that's out there as well? Or is that probably not going to happen because of this concept of, you know, we've got multiple opinions and the congregation gets to decide who the elders are?
Well, I think it is a danger. And fortunately, in Presbyterian government, there is a gradation of courts. So, for instance, let's say a session decides something that upsets a member, that member can appeal to the presbytery. That actually happened in the congregation where I served. I won't get into the particular issue, but a member of our congregation wasn't happy with something that we had decided to do. And so they wrote a letter to our presbytery, and the presbytery had a judicial body look at that, review it, and make a ruling on it. And they in this case, favored what we had decided, and the member still wasn't happy with that, and so then appealed the presbytery's decision up to the national body, which is called synod. And so there are these courts of the church that, in a sense, reflect even our civil court system, which allows people to have a voice and to make sure that there is greater wisdom and further protection brought, because certainly a local group of elders can err, a presbytery can err, and so that's why we need the accountability and association with other people so that they can come in and help us.
Good. I was hoping that would be the answer you were going to give, to talk about the, you know, the appeals process and whatnot. And just as a point of clarification, our system of church government does not reflect the courts in America. The courts in America reflect Presbyterian church government, as
yes,
do
they
other
do.
Branches
yes,
of,
yeah.
of Presbyterian,
yes, they do.
Or other branches of the government as well. So they were modeled after, after the church, not vice versa. Just as a clarifying comment for those listeners out there.
I gladly accept that.
And happily accept it. But Aaron, I think, you know, to be critical or to be discerning about our own form of church government, while I think it's biblical and I think it's the best, a session can easily become controlling. And it happens when they forget that they're shepherds. It happens when they forget that they are to gently lead the sheep. It happens when they sometimes begin to treat sheep like wolves. It happens when, you know, they can't tolerate disagreement from the body. I think some of the ways I've seen it in my life is, sometimes sessions will try to cram through a particular pastor or elder, and they say, this is the man we want. And I remember being told by somebody not in the RPCNA, so you can stop all speculative guessing. But I remember a man once told me when the elders put a man forward to be pastor, the congregation's role really is to rubber stamp that. Mm-hmm. And I remember saying, well, that's not Presbyterianism. It's the congregation's right and power to exercise in the selection of a pastor. And that's why, like Barry said, I think the appeals are so important. Presbyterianism gives a platform to people who want to disagree. It gives a platform to the minority. And I think I've always been convinced, and I think Barry would probably agree, that pastors and elders need to be reminding their congregation of this. You know, it's one thing to say, yep, you've got that right, but if you want to complain, you go figure it out yourself. I haven't been in that situation, but I've kind of promised myself, if somebody ever just, I'm going to sit down and help them write their appeal, even though it's an appeal against me, because I'm so, again, hopelessly Presbyterian. They have that right. They have a right to appeal to presbytery, and they have a right to appeal to synod. And we, you know, we can't love the principles of Presbyterianism and then, when people start using them, freak out about it, right? This is how Christ has organized his church, and there's so much wisdom in it, as difficult as that process can sometimes be. And so that's another way, you know, I think that's another way sessions can sometimes wrongly control and not lead their congregation, is not reminding the congregation of the rights and the privileges that are theirs by Presbyterian government. So.
You know, our last episode was on catechisms, and this is just another testament as to why it's important to be catechized yourself and to catechize your children so they know how this stuff works. So read the governing documents of your church, know how it works, so that if something does seem to be amiss, you know what the appropriate steps are that you can take to go through that. And so you know, like, what the jobs of the office holders are and what the role of the congregation is in these various processes, because it is spelled out in very, very clear English. Sometimes not so clear English, but it's pretty easy to understand. We talked about that last time too. If you didn't listen, go back and listen to that.
Well, I think that brings us to the conclusion of another episode of 3GT. Thanks for tuning in, and please head on over to iTunes to subscribe to this podcast and check us out at 3GT.fm.